Welcome to New Books in Literature, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm G.P. Gottlieb, host of this channel, and today I'm talking to former McDonald's general counsel and author Shelby Yastro, who together with professional golfer Tony Jacklin wrote the novel Bad Lies. Published in 2018 by Mascot Books, Bad Lies tells the story of fictional pro golfer Eddie Benenson and his legal battle against a major golf magazine that published a series of articles accusing him of cheating and using performance-enhancing drugs. These articles destroy Benenson's career, and he sues the magazine and its corporate owner. Even those with only a passing acquaintance with the legal world will be drawn into the cunning dance of lawyers who try to choreograph every aspect of the trial before they ever stand before a judge and jury. And as if you were on that jury, you'll want to cast your vote for truth and justice. But justice isn't always so clear. Shelby Yastro began writing books based on civil lawsuits while working as an executive for the McDonald's Corporation. He started at McDonald's in 1978 as vice president and chief counsel of litigation, and in 1982 became general counsel and executive vice president. Yastro's first book, Undue Influence, was published in 1991. It was about a court battle based on an actual 1963 case regarding an $8 million will and reached number 7 on the Chicago Tribune bestseller list. His second novel, Under Oath, published in 1994, concerned a malpractice case based on other issues he had previously litigated. Yastro also wrote a nonfiction book, Vision to Legacy, about franchising and the history of Great Clips, the world's largest hair salon franchisor. In 2016, Yastro, also a golfer, became friends with professional golfer Tony Jacklin, who adds insight into the complex world of professional golf described in the novel. The recipient of many awards, Jacklin was honored in 1970 by Queen Elizabeth, who gave him the title of Commander of the British Empire. And now I'd like to welcome author Shelby Yastro to the New Books in Literature podcast. Hi, Shelby. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So first of all, I'd like to start out by asking you if you could talk a little bit about how you came to write this book and how it happened that one of the greatest golfers of his generation became your co-writer.
Yeah, it's a good question because people are always surprised that I started writing books when I became after I became an executive at McDonald's Corporation. The fact is that everyone, especially lawyers, always think that there's a book in them somewhere. And I found myself having so much time to kill because I traveled a lot. I was on airplanes and hotels flying all over. And I was trying to come up with the idea of a book, but one day I was in New York talking to some advertising executives, and somewhere along the line got to tell them a story about a case I had back in the 60s. And a couple of people remarked what a great novel that would be. So I went back to my hotel room and started writing that very night about that case, but I changed the situation a lot, but the same points of law were involved. Case. And that became Undue Influence, which reached the national bestseller list. It was very flattering and unexpected.
Okay, and then you wrote a second book, a novel.
Yes, after my first book did a nice job in sales, I had some demands or requests to write more. So I wrote a book, another civil case. I don't write about murders. And this was a medical malpractice trial. A woman suing her doctor after she has a child with birth defects. And that was called Under Oath. And those were the two novels I had previously written.
And then how did you happen to write a book about golf?
Well, I really like golf. It's been a passion of mine since I was really a young kid. And there are really no decent books out there about golf in the mystery genre or courtroom. And so I thought for some time about what kind of civil case could I have involving golf in a courtroom situation. And the sports pages over the last several years have been filled with stories about performance-enhancing drugs for Lance Armstrong, Barry Bonds, and others. And In 2008, the Professional Golf Association started drug testing on the professional tour. And so I thought that might be good. But I also brought in allegations of alleged cheating by our hero. And he brought a libel suit, that's defamation of character. For those who might not know, libel and slander are basically the same thing, but libel is when the lies are written, slander is where they are uttered verbally. And he brings this lawsuit against the publisher, magazine, and its owners. And the book is really the trial. It starts, first page of the book is the first day of the trial. And one thing that makes writing about lawsuits either easier or more readable is that you can start right in the middle of the action in the trial and then bring out all the background through the witness's testimony as to what happened. Whereas when you don't have a courtroom situation, you kind of have to go back and set up all the background the first chapter or two, which sometimes is interesting. Mm-hmm. So that's why writing through the courtroom lens really makes for a faster start.
I thought that the book's biggest tension was between First Amendment rights and the damage done by reckless reporters. What did you think?
Well, I'm glad that you caught the drift of the book, namely that the First Amendment can be freedom of speech, freedom of the press can be used as a sword as well as a shield. And in my experience, in my professional life, I've discovered that the press, whether through neglect or deliberately, I hate to say that, but maybe it's true, misstates facts to sell papers or increase the listenership, and or at least embellish the facts. So I wanted to bring out how in a trial this could create terrible problems in that a reporter can write a story based on hearsay, based on a few tidbits of information, based on his own supposition, instead of hard facts. And then in the repetition of the story, it becomes fact and accepted fact. And this is especially dangerous in some of our jurisdictions where reporters are not required to name the sources of their information. They're allowed, for example, in Illinois, where this trial takes place, in Chicago, the law is that a reporter need not disclose his sources. So a reporter can get up and say, well, somebody told me that Galit is a communist. Well, who told you that? Well, I don't have to. I can't tell you. So now you've got that terrible, damning allegation out there without any support. And people tend to believe it because it was written down, and yet there is no substantiation, which could ruin lives and careers.
Yeah, I was shocked about it when I was reading about this character. How did you come up with the idea for the reporter Max Reed? Just based on general situations where this happened?
That is the subject of a defamation libel suit. Then I have to have the reporter who wrote the article try to defend it. And I created Max Reed for this role, who I tried not to make too sleazy, but by the time he's done being cross-examined by Charlie Mayfield, who is actually the hero of the book more than the golfer, Charlie Mayfield is the golfer's lawyer. Max Reed is now shown in his true character as a devious person who was just trying to impress his editors with a story that he has scooped.
One of your many executive positions at McDonald's was as longtime corporate spokesperson, and I know you told me that you were close with Ray Kroc. So how did you handle reporters who, in writing stories about your company, McDonald's, embellished the truth, or ruined the truth, or sidled the truth?
When you say, how did I handle them, that's probably, I wish I could have handled some of them, but there's two ways to approach these. It's like the old song, no one to hold them and no one to hold them. Sometimes the best thing you can do with a story is ignore it. Because if you come back and deny it, then you're reminding people those allegations are out there. And it's especially true when you're involved with a company like McDonald's, which is kind of a household word. So if a story were to come out about nutrition, for example, and we have a lot of stories to tell on that, good stories, it might be better not to respond and start saying McDonald's denies that its food is unhealthy or something like that, because the denial itself repeats the assertion. And yet, sometimes you have to make a phone call without doing it publicly and try to straighten the record out. And reporters are reasonable people. I mean, they're fine in most cases. We went through that with the recent movie about Ray Kroc called The Founder. It was totally false. The allegations about him were evil and tragic. And when I went to because I knew the facts, I was involved in the situation that was covered by the movie, I went to the producer, three of us, and through a spokesperson to try to get the producer to change the story, and he told us to, you know, go away. He ignored us. It was rude. And it was Harvey Weinstein. You can't really handle them. You just want to get the facts out there and hope somebody reports them accurately. And most people try to. I think more of the problems are innocent than intentional.
Well, that's positive. Let's get back to the book. Can you explain the meaning of the title, Bad Lies?
Yes, Bad Lies is a play on words. It's the game of golf. By the way, the protagonist here, Eddie Benison, the golfer, this book doesn't require that the reader know anything about golf. He could have just as easily been a baseball player or a cyclist. But in the golf, the word lie describes the position of the golf ball. And so that a bad lie is where the ball is sitting deep in the turf or the grass or behind a tree or on a steep slope, And we always say that a golfer has a bad lie if it's a hard shot to hit. And then in the world of libel and defamation, a lie, of course, is a misstatement of truth. So I thought it would be a good play on words. The magazine is accused of writing bad lies, and the golfer has to figuratively deal with the bad lie that he got, namely his stories out there, putting him behind the tree, behind the eight ball, so to speak. We played around with several titles, but we stayed with that one.
Now it makes sense. So one of the accusations against Benison is that he used performance-enhancing drugs. But I thought golf was more about skill rather than strength or speed. So how could a golf game be improved with drugs of any kind?
Well, a couple of ways. First of all, I would say that all sports are a matter of skill, but they also require, in many cases, endurance and strength. Take, for example, one of the most widely publicized performance-enhancing drug cases in recent times has been the baseball player Barry Bonds. And baseball, I don't think any drugs could help a baseball player hit a curveball, but once he hits it, he can hit it further because he might have added strength. And the same is true with golf. A golfer who takes these drugs that are now forbidden on the Professional Golf Association Tour, he probably wouldn't improve his skill in terms of shaving 5 yards off of the 6-iron or curving a shot around a tree, but it might help him hit the ball another 10 or 15 yards further with just the strength. And also, something that people aren't, I try to make this point in the book, people don't think of golf as a real athletic endeavor. But when you're out there walking 6 miles, 4 days a row under the intense pressure of a tournament, not to talk about time on the range, hitting balls, practicing, statistics that show that those who are in better condition play better near the end, because it's, you know, it takes a toll on the body. And steroids can help you during those last several holes be better, perform better than you could without them.
You mentioned, you already mentioned the brilliant Charlie Mayfield, medicine's lawyer. And I'm interested to know, is he based on anybody, or did you invent him as the quintessential lawyer who knows exactly how to play the game?
That's a good question. Exactly, both. He is the quintessential lawyer who knows exactly how to play the game. But it's based on a lawyer who I had, with whom I had the privilege of working when I was a very young lawyer myself. One of the first cases I worked on in my professional career was before I went to McDonald's, but it was a case involving McDonald's in Peoria, Illinois. And it started out as a relatively minor case, but it grew exponentially into a federal antitrust case. And it was the future of the company depended on it. And the company we sued, the people we sued, started, that was, these were the forerunners of Hardee's. And the lawyer we hired in Peoria was, his name was John Cassidy. And I described John Cassidy, but I described Charlie Mayfield, gray-haired, overweight, shuffling, curmudgeon, sarcastic, clever, cunning kind of a lawyer who sometimes made as many points with a question as he did with an answer, and how he prepped his witnesses so that he knew exactly what they should say, how they should say it, when they should look at the jury, little mannerisms, which is so important to the trial lawyer that people don't usually think about if they're not in the business. And Charlie had a marvelous way of getting evidence in record that maybe shouldn't have been there, and throwing snides out about his opposing lawyers. And he had what we call trust me eyes, those big bloodhound eyes when he talked to the jury, that just, he's an honest, this is a believable person. Probably an antithesis of most politicians, but he is everybody's uncle, very avuncular, wise, funny, humorous guy who could cut an opposing witness to ribbons with a stiletto, and they wouldn't even know they're being cut up.
But his opposing team was also very high-powered. One was a very respected professor of law, and another one was also a pretty strong lawyer, pretty strong Chicago lawyer. So my question is, they both prepared their witnesses clearly, and you illustrated how they helped them prepare to say things correctly in the exact right way. But then all of a sudden the reporter's called up and he's so unprofessional. I wrote this down, his boss calls him the biggest boob since Humpty Dumpty, which is pretty funny. But can you explain that?
Yeah, I think I can, because of a personal experience. As a lawyer who tried cases quite a bit, I did what all lawyers do. We told our witnesses, our own witnesses, when I examine you, there are, answer my questions, listen carefully, just answer. When the opposing lawyer cross-examines, there are only three answers: yes, no, or I don't know. You cannot elaborate or embellish the answers. Just answer yes or no. If there's more, I'll bring it out when I get back on the witness stand myself. Max Reed couldn't do that. Max Reed had this penchant for volunteering information. And if they were to say, and did you meet with so-and-so? Yes, we met at such and such a restaurant and we talked about thus and so on such and such a date. Just open the door to more questions.
He should have just said yes or no.
That's right. I know my own personal experience. Years ago, I was a witness in a lawsuit. And I felt trapped myself. You know, state your name. I said, Shelby Yastro. I'm a lawyer. I'm so such and such an age. I got my degree from Northwestern. Such and such an age. You know, we just are up there. We want to talk. And it's so hard. So I've learned after I made that mistake myself, that I prep witnesses. I mean, I'm could be pretty nasty. And I've dealt with some of the greatest lawyers. But I've watched them work. I mean, even telling a witness, take off that Rolex wristwatch and shave that beard off and things of that nature, because we want to make a certain presentation to the jury. And for example, you have a woman in a divorce case who's asking for a lot of money in terms of alimony or property. You don't want her up there in a 1999 dress. You know, you want her to look like she's accustomed to a well-heeled life. And it's the same thing. We not only prep the witnesses on their answers, but on their appearance and on their attitude and the whole schmear. Very important.
Clearly. There was a part that I'd like to hear a little more from you about what's expected in the game of golf. And there's a little section where Mayfield asks Max Reed, still on the stand, how many clubs he has in his bag. And that's like, it just blows up. Can you talk about that scene?
Yes, I can. And it's interesting because you just said Mayfield asked him how many clubs he had in his bag. And Mayfield never asked that question. And explain that. And that's how he was clever. Max Reed was trying to make the point that golf is a game of honor, it's a gentleman's game, and that we don't need referees or umpires. We call penalties on ourselves, and cheating is such a rare thing. And I brought out examples of people who violate the rules accidentally. They're so technical sometimes. And he made the big point when he's being cross-examined, and Charlie let him into this, that I would never break the rules playing golf. So then Charlie asked him if he belongs to this fancy country club, you know, to prejudice the jury a little bit. And does he play for money? And does he play for trophies? Yes, a little bit. And then Charlie said to him, is there a rule about how many clubs players have in the bag? And Max Reed says, yes. The limit is 14. Can't have more than 14 clubs in your bag. Then Charlie said, would I be lying if I told you that we had someone count the clubs in your bag and there are 16? And that puts the witness in a horrendous situation. Now he knows that somebody's been counting the clubs in his bag. And the question wasn't, do you have that many clubs? The question was, would I be lying if I said you did? But of course, the implication is that he did have that many clubs in his bag, no matter how he answered.
But how were they able to go and count his clubs in his bag? Isn't that?
He said in the question, he said, in the book, it says, we had someone go into the bag room of your country club and count the clubs in the bag. And that's not hard to do. You know, you could call any country club and say, would you somebody count the clubs in my bag? And say, my name is Max Reed. And it's not hard to do. You can go back there and send a caddy or one of the employees down to count the clubs. And in fact, I've seen that done in tournaments. So that was Charlie's way of getting the fact to the jury that Max Reed himself fudged with the rules while writing damning stories about Eddie Benison, supposedly fudging.
Right. Do you know any real cases in which a professional golfer has been accused of cheating in any way?
Yes, there have been several instances of golfers accused of cheating. They haven't, to my knowledge, resulted in courtroom lawsuits, but some ended up as hearings before the Professional Golf Association that they worked on among themselves. There's also been a few allegations in more recent years about golfers using performance-enhancing drugs. There are rumors that Tiger Woods has done it, but of course, no evidence of that for sure. B.J. Singh was penalized for doing that. There was a woman golfer some years ago, Janet Blaylock, who was accused of cheating. And there are several instances where there are allegations of certain pros disobeying the rules, whether by claiming the ball was in casual water and taking a free drop, as opposed to hitting it from where, from a bad lie. And some of those in recent sports pages, a couple of accusations against Gary Player. But no lawsuits as far as I know. And then there was the famous case in the Masters tournament where Roberto Di Vincenzo lost because they had the wrong score on his card, and it was put down there by his opponent because each player keeps the other player's score, and his opponent wrote a 4 for Roberto on the 17th hole at Augusta when he had a 3. And Roberto signed the scorecard, so he had to accept the 4, which meant that he lost the Masters by that one stroke.
Because he signed it, and that was assuming that he went through it and looked for any mistakes.
Yeah, and the number, it was interesting because the number at the end was correct. He shot a 66 or 67 that day, and the total was correct. But if you added up the numbers in the scorecard, it would have been one higher because Tommy Aaron, who kept his score, wrote down the wrong number. So that's how a player can be penalized and lose a golf tournament because it's a trivial mistake that had nothing to do with his skill. And then there was a story of Greg Statler in the Andy Williams Open who his ball came to rest under a bush and it rained on Saturday's round and on Sunday, Saturday. Because it rained the night before, he put a towel down because he had to kneel. He didn't want to get his pants wet. So he kneeled, put his knee down on the towel, bent down, and from that sweating position, chipped the ball out into the fairway. Amazingly, he finished the round and wrote down his score, and the next day was third in the tournament. But some viewers on TV called in and said he violated rule such and so by improving his stance. And because he had already signed the scorecard for that day, Saturday, and this was discovered on Sunday, disqualified, so he lost everything. So the rules in tournament golf are the subject of many terrible stories, and those are just two that reached the papers, sports pages. And there was another woman who just this last year mismarked her ball and was denied winning a tournament because she, Lexi Thompson, because she moved her ball. They showed her with a close-up lens on TV, maybe a 16th or a quarter of an inch, and not even closer to the hole. Just it's hard to be that precise. And it was about a 12-inch putt. But after she made it, they... viewers called in. And the next day, she was penalized.
I don't play golf, but I still found it so fascinating to read these kind of stories of what was happening in the novel itself. And these extra stories are fascinating. Could you talk a little bit about your work at McDonald's, specifically your work as chief legal officer? Just because it's interesting, and you bring so much law into the book. So, what can you tell us?
Well, that's interesting. I guess I could back up a little bit. I got out of law school in 1959 at Northwestern University, and my first 2 weeks at this law firm in Chicago, a gentleman walks in off the street without an appointment, which is almost unheard of in a large firm. And when he talked to one of the partners, he said, "What are you going to do?" And the fellow said, "I want to start a chain of 15-cent hamburger stands." They immediately said, "What kind of jerk is this?" So they called me in as the youngest lawyer in the firm. I'd been 2 weeks out of school to work on this client's matter. And this client happened to be Ray Kroc, who founded McDonald's. And that was, just the luck of the draw. I was walking down the hall. It changed my life because I did work for him for 3 years in his law firm. And then some years later, he hired me to come in and take over all the litigation at McDonald's. And I was promoted a few years later to general counsel. That's his chief legal officer of the whole company worldwide. And we're a large company, of course. We were in 140 countries at the time. But I also, as a member of the top senior executive, top management, had other departments before besides law reporting to me. They included insurance, transportation, social responsibility, all non-restaurant real estate, government relations, which had to do with lobbying and monitoring and writing legislation. And when I say non-restaurant real estate, it's a big job because McDonald's has been the largest owner of real estate for about 35 years now in the country, retail real estate. I'm not talking about places like Georgia mm-hmm. Pacific with acres of timber. And we had, just in the United States, over 50 offices. And worldwide, we had about 150 offices or 175 offices. So basically, every day we were closing a lease on an office building or a remodel or a revamping. And so I had several people working on all those, just our office buildings, plus the restaurants. When we close a restaurant, sell it, that was under my jurisdiction. And sometimes people don't realize excess property. For example, years ago we wanted to put a McDonald's restaurant in a shopping center, one in Las Vegas, and the owner was not easily persuaded to sign a lease with us. So we ended up buying the whole shopping center. And we put in our McDonald's, and now it fell into my department to get rid of the other 90% of the shopping center. We had the same problem when in Winnetka, Illinois, when we put a drive-in in Winnetka. It raised a lot of eyebrows, and we had to do some of that. So the excess property and the non-restaurant real estate was a big part of my job. We had, I think at one point, 28 lawyers doing nothing but that, just the dealing with the restaurants. Non-restaurant real estate. We had, over the time, we had over 100 lawyers working for the company. So it was a pretty big job. But as I say, I spent as much of it in just being on the executive management team. I would be involved with all sorts of non-legal discussions, even discussing new menu items, new advertising campaigns, whether or not to open restaurants in Russia. Those were all things that I worked on. And then if we did them, I had to implement them from a legal point of view, like the Russia restaurants.
So interesting. So when people think of McDonald's lawsuits, and I understand there must have been quite a number of them over the years, but many of us think about the case of the hot coffee spilling. It was in the 80s. Can you talk about that? About the $3 million settlement that we all still remember?
Well, okay, it was a $3 million verdict. But what happened was, it was really interesting. I happened to be in my car early that morning going to a board meeting, and my radio was on, and an announcer was talking about a jury in Albuquerque, New Mexico, returned a verdict last night against McDonald's Corporation. My ears perked up when I heard that. Stella Liebig, the plaintiff, was granted about $3 million because hot coffee spilled in her lap. I almost drove off the highway because I didn't know about the case. And let me back up on that because it sounds horrendous that I wouldn't know about it. We had all sorts of litigation, franchisee suits, antitrust cases, tax cases, real estate cases. And we always had a lot of what we call personal injury cases. But in our situation, they were almost always very minor by our standards. In other words, they're slip and fall. Somebody come into a store and slip on a mopped floor or something. We didn't have the kind of cases where people were killed. But I had a rule that I had to be told about what we called sensitive cases. For example, if a young child was hurt on the playground. You know, kids are our franchise. We can't allow that. Or if somebody allegedly got sick or found a foreign object in the food or something like that, those are the kind of things I'd have to know about. But when somebody claims that they got burned by hot coffee that they themselves spilled, it wasn't alleged or asserted that our employee spilled the coffee or that the lid came off. It was just hot coffee. Nobody mentioned that case to me until I heard about it on the radio. And remember, we have, when I retired, Billy, we had about 30 million customers every day, just in the United States. So something could go wrong one in a million times. It happened 30 times a day at McDonald's. So it wouldn't be surprising that I wouldn't know about someone who spilled a little coffee on her lap. Until the newspapers. As it turned out, we were able to get that case, that verdict, thrown out, and a new trial was ordered by the judge. So there's no liability. And then we elected to settle with Mrs. Liebig for a lot less money, rather than go through the publicity of a new trial, because we figured every reporter on the planet would be there. Mm-hmm. So we made a nice settlement with her, and she was very nice. But what happened is her grandson had just got a new sports car, and they went through the drive-thru. She ordered a Big Mac and a cup of coffee, which, by the way, was her typical fare there. She did it almost every day. And she put the coffee between her legs on the seat of the car. And while she was opening the Big Mac, her grandson turned down the driveway and turned right on the street, and some of the coffee sloshed onto her lap. And when we interviewed the jury later, you know, what did we do wrong? Well, nothing, but she was a nice lady, and McDonald's could afford it. And, you know, you make that much money every 10 minutes, so give her $3 million. And that's the way the jury system works sometimes in the United States. We're the only country, by the way, in the world that allows trial by jury as a matter of right in civil cases. In other jurisdictions, England, for example, on which our law is based, a judge may say a case is too complicated for a jury, or there's too much emotion, or it's not necessary. But in the United States, you can get a jury for anything, and most jurors, although the Constitution says a jury by your peers, they're not peers. So most juries, and it's a good system basically, but most people we know get off jury duty. And the people who sit on it are usually retirees or unemployed people, because they get like $8 a day or something. And they tend to side with the big, with the plaintiffs, the injured party, rather than a big corporation. Just that's the nature of the game.
So interesting. We just got to hope justice prevails, right?
That's the jury system. You know, we saw it with the O.J. Simpson trial. He won the trial, the criminal trial, and then lost the civil case. The only difference was they were tried in different venues. And he had a African-American predominant jury in one case and a white jury in the other. And people were surprised there was different verdicts, but that's the reality of the game.
So I could keep talking to you because you have so many great stories, but I've taken up enough of your time, Shelby, and I'd like to just ask you the traditional New Books question. What's next for you? Is there another book in the works?
Well, I've been playing with the idea. In fact, I started a book once and I put it aside and I started messing with it again. I wanted to write a story about, I'll call it intrigue in the executive suite. I thought I would have a story about, that brought two concepts together. Two executives vying for the top job, chairman, CEO of a company. How they are working against each other, trying to sabotage the other one, and lining up other executives to be on their sides. And one of the issues over which they would fight would be an issue of what I call corporate espionage. There's a lot of that, and I got involved with it in a way. For a while, I was in charge of the toys that went into Happy Meals for McDonald's, sourcing the toys in China and in the Far East. And we would find manufacturers over there to do our little toys for the Happy Meals. And this was a big deal. There were about 75 or 80 million of them a month. And I learned in that the, especially in Asia, the amount of theft in terms of intellectual property, trademarks, copyrights, patents. And there's just armies of people out there trying to find out what Hallmark's going to do so they can come out with a Christmas tree ornament cheaper and earlier, and what McDonald's toys are going to be so Burger King or somebody else could come out with a toy the week before. Mm-hmm. So corporate espionage is kind of an interesting thing, and it's almost unheard of in the to the average person. But just look what's going on with our election and hacking and cyberspace espionage right now. It's very common. I have a brother who is in the clothing business, and there are people out there just stealing designs and patents and ideas right and left. So
what you're saying is there's no shortage of subjects for you to cover in future books.
A good friend of mine, Scott Turow, who helped me a lot, we're still good friends, writes criminal cases along with John Grisham. But I try to show that there's as much drama when people are fighting for their pocketbook as when they're trying to stay out of prison. And my first book had to do with a will contest. What could be more mundane? But there's a lot of drama.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your stories and sharing your time with us, Shelby Yestro. It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Ellen. Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to this podcast from the New Books Network. Once again, I'm GP Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature. And today I've been talking with Shelby Yestro about his novel, Bad Lies. Join the New Books Network and learn both about my upcoming podcasts and those of other hosts in a variety of categories. Goodbye until my next conversation for the New Books Network.